Peter Golden is an award-winning journalist, novelist, biographer, and historian. From the author of Come Back Love, Wherever There Is Light is his second novel. It is a tale of 20th century America chronicling the decades-long love affair between a Jewish immigrant and the granddaughter of a slave. Again, the new novel is Wherever There Is Light, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Peter Golden back to the roundtable this morning. Peter, thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
How did this particular novel come about?
I had been fascinated for years by the idea that African-American colleges rescued Jews from the Holocaust by giving them visas. They were Jewish professors that had been fired in 1935 by Hitler, and they couldn't get out of the country, and so the only way they could come into America was either have someone who could take care of them, who would pledge to pay for them, or have a job. But it was the Depression. There weren't lots of jobs. And the African-American colleges gave these hundreds of professors jobs and brought them into this country and their families.
How long have you known about this, and has this been rattling around as to something that you could possibly attack in the form of a novel?
For 20 years, a woman wrote an unreadable book about some of these issues, and I her clearly English wasn't her first language, and I went to try and find her. This was in the days before the internet. I finally tracked her down in Washington, and I went down there and I tried to get in to see her, and I waited for a couple of days on and off at her apartment house, and a woman came out and told me that she had just died. So I couldn't get really what happened. I believe her father was one of these people. I wanted to know what happened on these campuses in an age when segregation was so strict that people, African Americans and whites, couldn't get buried in the same cemetery. So I was curious what would happen to these, especially if the professors had children, teenage or older teenage children, what would happen when they all got together. And so that was sort of the basis of the book.
Much of the book takes place 1938.
That's where it starts, yeah.
What is it about that year? Why start at that time?
Well, historians have a habit, and I don't know that it's a good one, but it helps to organize. It helps to organize the world about when something starts. They debate these things. And 1938, most people say the Kristallnacht, where in Austria and in the Sudetenland and in Germany, Goebbels set loose these thugs on Jews and broke up their stores, thus the shattered glass was the Kristallnacht. Most people believe that's sort of the beginning of what we would come to see as the Holocaust. And so getting out by 1938, it started to get really hard to get out of Germany. So that was about as late as I could get them out. And I wanted him, Julian, the main character, who is the son of these people who had come earlier, he had made a fortune as a bootlegger. And so I needed him to be past that a little bit. And so it worked out time-wise, it was a good time frame for the book. But historically, that's the reason.
Made his money as a bootlegger, then into real estate.
Right.
It is Julian Rose. And then we meet Kendall Wakefield.
Right.
Tell us about Kendall.
Kendall Wakefield is the daughter, the granddaughter of the founder of this college, who was a runaway slave who made a fortune in the catering business in Philadelphia, which actually happened. And he decides that what he's going to do is build a college on the plantation where he was born. So he goes down to Florida and buys the land and has his daughter, Kendall's mother, her name is Garland, has Garland run this college, and Kendall is her daughter. And Garland believes that Kendall is going to grow up to manage the family fortune and run the college. And she has other ideas. She wants to be a painter and she wants to live in Paris. And so the conflict between the two is severe.
When you decide on the fact, the historical part of this, do the facts always have to align, or how much do you give yourself fictional license to play?
I'm pretty good on facts of things. The playing comes in the creation of the internal world of these characters. Mm. I tell people this all the time as I've been going around and lecturing. When you pick up a biography and you have the biographer writing about the internal world of some historical figure, unless that biographer has a letter or an interview or something that says so-and-so felt that way about this, that biographer is writing fiction. Mm. And he's projecting what he would possibly think from the available facts into an internal world of a historical character. So I do that. I think I'm pretty good about the large facts, you know, when the wars start, when the wars end. That was important. Paris, what was going on in Paris. A lot of the book takes place in Paris after the war. So you have to be pretty good about what inflation was like and those kinds of things. But I'm not overly obsessive about it. But I think the big things you have to get right.
You mentioned Paris. Talk to us about what it is about that city that was so instrumental in the lives of these characters. And then I'll ask the follow-up question, which is, beyond that, they travel quite a bit.
Right. Paris, for Americans, I mean, and a lot of people have written about this, but Paris for Americans was sort of this land of beauty and refinement and actually sexual freedom. In the case of Kendall and Julian, Paris was Parisians were relatively indifferent to African Americans and whites being together. In fact, they were big lovers of jazz. Some enterprising woman went over to Paris after the war, or before the war, and opened up a soul food restaurant. I mean, African American culture was very popular among Parisians, and they didn't mind as in America, it was illegal for African Americans, whites to marry in most states, if not all. And it wasn't like that in Paris. So that became a way to look at them in a different circumstance.
A more accepting circumstance. Right. Certainly more accepting than what could be found here in the United States.
Yeah, they start off in Florida, in South Florida, which was the most segregated state in the country with the most lynchings at the time. So that was a rough time. And then they go to Greenwich Village, supposedly liberated Greenwich Village. And we find that I found doing my research that it wasn't quite as liberated as people thought. There were just no signs, but there was lots of segregation. Mm. And still, I think people will talk about that currently now in American cities.
What is it about the relationship that keeps them going through all these trials and tribulations?
Well, I think that for Julian, Kendall is, this guy is a gangster. He's been a killer. She's his redemption, I think. I mean, for him, it's the one thing that redeems him is that he loves her. And I think for her, she feels a lot of that. Both of them come out of difficult childhoods and have had a difficult time. But she has her art, so she's distracted to some degree, and she's got her own personal problems. And I think ultimately she might come to that decision, but it's a lot harder for her than it is for him.
You do get the sense in reading the novel that there are always these things that are just within reach and then suddenly get grabbed away.
Yeah, that's a wonderful way for writers to create conflict and get the reader to turn the page. But I think life often works out that way for people. You think you're just about there and then it's gone, you know, it's an illusion. And there's always more to deal with or another thing to get through. And I think I was trying to write in the vein of realism, and so that's why I constructed it that way.
And you wanted a story that took place over a long period of time.
I wanted to show what changed and what didn't change between the late 30s and the mid-60s. Don't forget, in the 30s, African-Americans, the newspapers and the groups were focused on trying to get anti-lynching legislation passed. They couldn't get President Roosevelt's support to pass to make lynching a federal crime and hopefully start to correct it the way that kidnapping ultimately became a federal crime and they stopped that. They couldn't get Roosevelt to sign on to that. And what they're dealing with later in 66 is a whole different story.
And it's all hard in different ways.
Yeah, I think so. I think the other thing that fascinated
challenging.
Yeah, the other thing that fascinated me about Kendall was that she comes from a very wealthy, very well-educated family. And I was very curious about looking at that aspect of African-American life because I think it's underexplored. And there was plenty of that in the United States. And now we're starting to see some books and more things being written about that. And I think that's a great thing. And I was very curious about her family, the history of her family. And so that's in the book as well.
And how she represents that family.
Right.
In the telling of this, I mentioned your first novel, Comeback Love. How does this differ, do you think?
Oh, that's a really good question. they're more mature people in many ways. In Comeback Love, you see them as older people and they're grown there, but the story itself deals with people that are less mature in many ways. These both Kendall and Julian have had a harder time, and the world, as difficult as the world is at the moment, you have to understand the absolute horror of the Depression, and then, of course, of the war that followed that. And it was everywhere in American life. And then the revelations of the Holocaust, and not just the Holocaust, the slaughter all through Germany and Asia. It's still unimaginable. And I've been looking at it for a lot of my life. It still seems unreal in many ways.
Did you know the ending when you started? Did you know how these characters were going to end up?
Sort of, but I didn't. I went back and forth a few different times on that. I could have written, endings are funny. You can often write them, and sometimes you do write them many different ways. Hemingway, I think, wrote 29 endings to A Farewell to Arms. So that you can read them now in some special edition of the book. So I think I wrote a couple of them, and I looked at them, and I went with the one that I preferred.
And what leads to that preference? Is it a sense of that this is more satisfying and more realistic, and because there perhaps is no such thing as a ultimately happy ending?
I think a more satisfying reading. I think ultimately, you're writing for other people. You're not writing for yourself, and so you write to some degree what you think would be easier to digest, if as long as it's consistent with the characters. And I didn't really know how to do it. And so I wrote them and read them, and I preferred the other. So I wrote, then ultimately went with the one that I preferred reading.
Did you know when you were writing it that one felt better?
Yes, I did. In fact, the funny thing is, when I think of a first chapter of a book, I often think of the last chapter next.
Yes.
And I'm writing another book now, and I knew the ending. Now, I'm having the same problem. I don't know exactly what happens, but I know there's one of two possibilities. And so I will probably write them both and see which one I like better.
The name of the new novel is Wherever There Is Light. It is by Peter Golden. It is published by Atria Books. Peter, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
Great pleasure. Again, the title of the novel is Wherever There Is Light. It is published by Atria Books. Peter Golden is the author. You can find out more by going to petergolden.com. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.